Well, you're changing the game.
This is beyond the game. This is just trying to make your... I'm doing you a favor.
Well, this whole segment is changing the game, so
it is.
Let's continue on. Hello, everyone, and welcome once again to Irenicast. We are a weekly podcast dedicated to the exploration of faith and culture. We are your hosts. I'm Jeff.
I'm Mona.
And I'm Alan.
Thank you once again for joining us this week. This week, in particular, happens to be a very special week. Do you two know what I am referring to?
No.
Spring has finally come.
I don't think so.
Oh, East Coast people are like rejoicing. I was wearing shorts yesterday. My God, it was glorious. Okay, so no, that must not be the thing. What is it?
In California.
It's in California. It's like spring every day.
Shut up.
This is our 8th episode. And you may ask yourself, why is the 8th episode so important? Well, I will tell you why it's so important, because I can anticipate your thoughts.
It comes after 7.
That is true. It does come after 7, which is important because, statistically speaking, most podcasts, and I've heard a range between 5 and 7, but... we'll go with 7 to be safe, but most podcasts, the vast majority of podcasts, like 85 to 92% of podcasts, never make it to their 8th episode.
We did it!
Wow!
Oh, we are part of the elite. And not only that, interesting side note, Mona, this one's for you. Only 13% of podcasters are women. So you are also personally in an elite of
13% of the shows that don't make it to 8. 13% of the 90%. That's of the 10% that make it.
Yes.
But I love statistics. You know, that word's very hard for me to say.
It is me too. I have to think about it before I say it.
Statistics.
I took the class in college and people would ask me what I'm taking and I couldn't say it properly and I always felt like a moron.
not to sideline your point, Jeff. I think we should talk more about the fact that
that's super awesome. I'm super proud of us.
I just want to say it. There is one word that I've said completely wrong my whole life. And my wife and I actually got into an argument about it. How do you say the word suggestion? If you said it really slow, how would you say it? You would say like 2 syllables, right? And I always said, no. If you say it with 2 syllables, I always said suggestion. But technically it's
That's 3 syllables.
Sorry, it's suggestion. Did you know that?
Yeah, that's how I've always pronounced it.
The 2 G's are split.
The 2 G's, suggestion.
Yeah, so it's suggestion. Yeah. Anyway, we got into an argument and I sounded really stupid.
The sound of sug.
Yeah. Well, I told my wife, I was like, I started laughing at her when she pronounced it really slowly. And I told her, it's suggestion. And turns out I was wrong. So
wow.
How do you spell the word for a group of islands that starts with A-R-C-H?
Archipelagic. I can't pronounce that.
How do you say it, Jeff?
I have no idea what you're talking about.
Archipelago. I sound really dumb right now.
But I don't know.
I failed geography, so I have no idea. I don't even think I've ever heard that term.
Really?
Archipelago.
Anyway, we're getting sidetracked. So
we are.
So we have hit a milestone that has surpassed so many before us, and we are coming up towards a new milestone, which is our double digit episode 10.
What is that in dog years? Does that mean
we're 70? We're going to be 70.
Are there podcast years like dog years?
Ooh,
I don't know. That's a good question. I think they're just regular years. So when we hit episode 21, that means our podcast can buy beer. So we should celebrate by drinking beer while we have our conversation. So that's a next milestone right there.
Wait, you guys haven't been drinking this whole time?
I mean, I generally do, but
So 10 episodes is coming up, and that's another milestone. So we're going to do something a little special for our 10th episode. So we want to hear from you, our listeners, as far as at this point, we've done several different fun segments towards the end of our show. We've done Jesus or Jay-Z. We've done Famous Christians for 100 and several other ones. So we want to hear from you on, we're going to allow you to pick which segment we are going to finish our show with, our 10th episode. And not only that, but we are going to allow you to pick the conversation that we have, the topic that we discuss. In fact, not just one topic, everyone who submits a topic, we're going to do a rapid fire discussion where we're going to take all the list of the things that we have, put them together if there's any ones that are the same, and just kind of go through them and have five to 10 minute bursts of insight on those different issues and then move on. Insight might be a strong
word.
So are
we also reading people's quotes that they like have written in their opinions? Like, I think you should talk about this.
Yeah, that's a good idea.
Yeah, I think so.
This is what I think about it.
If it's not too long-winded. Or okay. Is it long-winded when they type? Long-typed-ed? I don't know.
Well,
we will just take what they say out of context.
Yes.
And then quote them.
Very good.
That's what we'll do.
If we have people tweet us, then they have to limit their tweet. You know?
Yes.
Yes. 140 characters. 44? 40? What is it?
What's our tweet handle again?
At Irenicast.
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 Boom. Yeah, that will be fun. What if we get like 60 write-ins? And then we have to do a minute each. That would be just craziness.
We may have to turn our 10th episode into a two-parter. Or just have an extra long, like, super-sized episode for that celebration.
Super-sized.
So.
It's a
date.
Yes, exactly. So let us know what you want us to talk about and which segment you'd like us to do for that particular week. And we will submit ourselves to your opinion.
We're
I just here. Slammed something on the table because I'm so excited. I don't know if you heard that. Did you hear that?
I did hear.
I'm so excited. All right. Anyway, this week we're going to be talking about racism. So it's a little bit of a heavy topic, and I'm sure that there's a lot of different opinions on that, but we feel like we've kind of addressed it in past episodes in passing, but we really want to take some time and talk about this issue that we believe is still prevalent in our country today. So on the other side of the music, hear our conversation. All right. So, like we said, we're going to talk a little bit about racism. And I think that this conversation is obviously like every conversation that we've had is very much motivated by our personal opinions and experiences, but also it seems to be a pretty big topic in our culture today with all of the shootings that have happened recently and all of the outcry from a lot of, especially our African-American communities in the places where these things have taken place. So
three, as Mona said earlier to us, three white people talking about racism, right?
You guys are white?
Yes.
Yes. It sounds really weird, doesn't it? And I think it could easily go in a self-congratulatory direction. And that sucks. Like it is... I just want to name that it is really hard to talk about this, no matter who you are. But I think if you are white, you grow up in a culture where you never really have to face racism. That's part of privilege, right? Like the privilege to avoid conversations about it, because it benefits you to avoid conversations about it. And so I think we need to first off say that we want to attend to race because, like Jeff said, we've been talking about it throughout the course of the podcast so far. It is a really important thing to talk about. And so we're talking about it because it needs to be talked about. Am I summing that up pretty well?
Yes. And we're not going to fix everything and we don't want to speak for other people, but everyone should be talking about it because it's all of our, it's our society's thing that we have to deal with.
Exactly. And I would say that in a lot of, well, I don't want to speak for you two, but I'm just going to make the assumption that in a lot of our backgrounds, a lot of people define it as a non-issue. There isn't any more racism. You know, Martin Luther King took care of racism or Oprah took care of racism or whatever, you know.
Or white people solved racism. Macklemore.
Exactly. Yeah, that's right.
Absolutely. I have friends and family who talk about the opposite. You know, racism doesn't exist yet. Now all we face is reverse racism. And there's this underlying feeling that racism is gone. And it's easy to point to maybe some places in the South or, you know, some selected places where racism exists, but it's always somewhere else. It's not in our communities. It's not in, you know, our daily life, but it's something we can, like, you can point to the story that came out today. I don't know if you read about this, about Parma, Missouri, but they elected their first female black mayor, and 5 out of 6 cops in that Missouri town quit because they cited safety concerns or something like that. Even though the population is only 700 people and the last murder was in like 1943, they quit because of who the mayor was that was elected. And so there's
they were afraid for their own safety. I don't understand.
Yes, I believe so.
In Missouri.
Yeah. This just came out today. There are people who take this issue very personally, and it's not just something that is facing communities of people who feel very underrepresented and where racism impacts them. But there are people in my background that talk about it from an opposite perspective. They feel as if this conversation is affecting them in a negative way. And so talking about this is important because we need to address those things.
We can see the effects of this all over the place. And one of the things that got us talking about doing this episode is all of the cases of police brutality and incarceration rates of cons that are way, way higher than white cons, for example. Although criminal justice is hopefully will soon be its own episode. And there are so many different facets to this. But I know several people who will not acknowledge that race could even be a factor. And that really makes me mad because to me, it seems so evident that there is a serious, serious issue in the system we all live in and navigate. This is a long history that we've all inherited. And just because civil rights happened does not mean that we've eradicated it. And so I think we need to pause at this point and define racism, because if you define it as being a member of the Klan, then, of course, most of us are not racist. Most of us are not walking around thinking, I literally want to kill Black people or people of Latino descent or whoever. However, if we see it as a larger system that systematically suppresses certain types of people because of what they look like or where they come from, then that is where we are all, every single one of us, complicit, right? Is that how you guys would define it?
Yeah, I would say that just our reality, our society has racist elements to it. And just by the fact of us being born into it and not seeing that those things exist, we're complicit in it. I don't want to say that just because you don't think about these things, you're a racist or whatever, but we are participating in a culture where there are some built-in things that are racist, right? There are some ways of being in the world that are racist. So just because, yeah.
Well, I'd like to clarify, just more of a clarifying question, because I think it's important and it's what I'm thinking of. A lot of people that I would talk to about this issue in certain circles would say, like we've talked about already, is that there's racism doesn't exist. It's been solved and everything like that. And I sort of understand that perspective, especially if you don't experience it. So the whole complicit thing, I'm wondering where's that line between someone who's just ignorant of it and someone who is confronted with the realities of that situation and the facts behind that situation and denies it at that place? Like, there seems to be a different level of that.
And I think people deny stuff like this happening for a lot of different reasons. I think our system teaches people to deny and to put their head in the sand. So I think you have to look at who that benefits when that happens, because it's certainly not people who have to bear the brunt of racism. But I think also it's easier to navigate the world if you don't have to think about the harsh realities of it. Like, if you can just live in your little bubble and, you know, and I don't know.
The face of racism has changed. We're sitting here trying to define it. And you're right. It's not our laws are now protecting more and more minorities. And we're not publicly saying these very racist, very aggressive things. But the face of racism has changed. It's much more invisible. It's much harder to pinpoint, and it's more a part of our world. So sometimes people say, you know, Satan's first move, his biggest sin is to convince people that he doesn't exist, right? Well, if yeah. Racism's big sin in our society is that it is invisible. There's sometimes we talk about things in a seminary called, in the middle of counseling classes, they talked a lot about how sometimes race plays this invisible role in our lives. And they talked about things like microaggressions or micro inequities. It's basically these little exchanges in our culture where they happen on an unconscious level, a subconscious level. And we treat people who are of different races than us in different ways. So even things like telling someone they speak good English or asking them where they're born when they're Asian, that's a way of relating to someone who's from a different race, but it's a way of expressing that they are actually less of an American than some other people. Or I'm thinking of there's a lot of different instances to these things, but they're verbal and nonverbal exchanges that confront people of color and people of different races on a daily basis. But for most of us, these things are totally not on the level of conscious thinking. We're not thinking we are, you know, we're going to go talk down to someone who's a different race than us, but they still happen because that's how our society has been built.
So you're thinking in terms of, like, if two white people have a conversation, you're rarely going to ask them, like, what is your country of origin? Are you German or Irish or whatever? But it's almost always asked if you're talking to someone of color.
Yeah. And in the business world, it's like there's patterns of being overlooked. Do you guys hear about that guy whose name was Jose and he applied to all of these places and nobody accepted his references, but then he applied to the same places under the name Joe? Have you heard about that story?
I did hear about that. Yeah.
You just remove that one letter from the name. Yeah. And so just because of your race, you are under-respected. devalued, overlooked. And these things happen again on a, like a subconscious level. I don't think people are sitting there, or most people are not sitting there saying, I'm not going to hire someone who's, you know, of Latino descent, but these things
happen. It's subconscious. You're absolutely right.
One more anecdote. I actually read, this is really cutting edge research, and there's not a whole lot of peer review to it yet, but there are people who are researching cars stopping at crosswalks for people who want to cross. And they're studying how often cars stop for people of different races. So if a white person is crossing, how many cars will pass, not letting that person cross until, you know, someone finally stops and let them go across. And if someone's black, how many cars will let them? And they're actually finding there is a disparity between your race will determine how quickly you can even get across the street, because people stop more often for different races than others.
Yeah, there have been several studies that kind of play on that same dynamic where you can, they've even had studies where people, like, they're in hooked up to an MRI machine and they're looking at their brain and seeing how their brain reacts differently when they're shown pictures of people of different color. So, I mean, there's a lot. And I think that that's part of the maybe the divide and why it's so difficult to convince some people that racism exists, because of that subconscious. It feels like an attack when it's pointed out to someone. And, you know, the whole fight or flight thing is someone, if they feel attacked, they're going to attack back, and they're shutting off that brain where they're able to sit down and have a good conversation about it. So I think that's one of the questions, is how do we acknowledge that subconscious part of our brain without putting someone in a place where they're feeling attacked?
Well, racist is such a loaded word, yeah. Right? That's like it's such a pejorative, thankfully has such a pejorative tone, but unfortunately it's so pejorative. And this is where I think the power structure of it hides really nicely. I mean, in a negative sense, that if racism can only refer to the KKK or only refer to people who are just vehemently, you know, using racial slurs and things like that, who are like incredibly spiteful. And if that word can only refer to those things or those folks, then all the rest of it, all of these everyday minute, what you would call microaggressions toward people of color, all of that stays invisible. And there literally is no word to talk about it and to refer to it. That's what's really interesting to me. And so one of the first things a lot of people learn when they take a sociology or anthropology class is to admit to themselves that I am a racist and everyone is a racist, because we live in a racist society. What do I mean when I say racist society? Let me just give a few historical points so we can just orient ourselves a little bit, because I think this will help us understand like what we mean by a system. So going back to the times of colonialism and imperialism, like from European expansion, there are immense documentations of missionary efforts and colonial efforts that siphoned people off, is the darker skinned people were less fit to rule themselves than lighter skinned people in native countries, like in native locations. So when the colonizers came into these locations, we're talking about around the world, not just in one or two places, everywhere from like Haiti to Indonesia, so on and so forth. When the white colonizers came in, they would select the lighter skinned native peoples that looked more like them to rule their peers, and created classes within these colonized societies. I mean, this is outlandishly widespread, but this is how colonial rule could occur, because they would pit people against each other in their own societies by making classes. Okay. So race has been exhibited from European expansionism, and we inherited that as a new country in the late 1700s. So John Blumenbach was the first person who coined the term Caucasian and used it to talk about how some races were more fit to rule others, that there was a hierarchy of race. In 1787, not long after that, you have the Three-Fifths Compromise. Do you guys remember that? What that was from long ago, your history classes?
Yeah, if you were three-fifths, think slave or something like that, or black, then you could vote or not vote, right?
I think it's in the Constitutional Convention. I think it's that black people and slaves in particular counted as three-fifths of a person.
That's right.
When calculating numbers for like the Congress and things like that. And then in 1883, Francis Galton started the whole science of eugenics, basically like trying to find biological substantive differences between races with science. And then in 1887, Jim Crow laws start in the South, which maintain legally separate but equal structures. So you can see this ideology that races are scientifically fundamentally different and some are better than others is so deeply embedded into how our society was built over time. And I'm getting a lot of this information from a study that PBS did. It's a really great interactive study. It's called Race, the Power of an Illusion. And I think it goes through 2000. So I'll get you the link, Jeff, to put in the show notes. So after the Holocaust, a lot of people saw the extremes of what racism could do, like anti-Jewish, like anti-Semitism, you know, and people around the world were shocked and mortified when the Holocaust was revealed. And so in 1950, shortly after World War II, the UN came out with a statement that said race has no scientific basis. We have to put this to rest, that there is a fundamental difference. There is absolutely no scientific basis for it, that this is, you could use this to have a hierarchy of persons. And then civil rights started kicking in. So not only do you have the Civil Rights Movement and the Civil Rights Act in 1963, but also, I don't know if you guys have read this book, but for me, it was pretty formative. And if someone did this now, it'd be incredibly offensive. But because this was kind of at the beginning of racial conversations in the U.S., it's a pretty significant book. It's a book called Black Like Me. Does that ring a bell to you?
I've heard of it.
Mm-hmm. 1961. So basically, a white sociologist did a social experiment and changed nothing about his appearance except took pills to make his skin darker. Again, it's not cool to do blackface in any capacity. So I just want to say that. But this book is pretty interesting because he documents going south, not changing his accent, his level of education, his dress, anything about himself except the color of his skin, and traveling south into the deep south, where just after Jim Crow had been raised, or maybe it was still in effect at that point, but documenting the horrific racism he experienced, people to his face just insulting him, asking about lewd sexuality, because that was a stereotype that black people were more animalistic and had more lewd sex than white people. I mean, on and on and on, just these obscene sorts of treatments from people who normally would have shook his hand and treated him like an adult if he had had white skin. And so it was kind of eye-opening for the country to start realizing, okay, wow, we have this crazy history. What do we do with this? And I, as a white person, a lot of times white guilt is a thing that happens because you're like, I've been benefiting from this system for a long time because I got born into the top of the pyramid, you know? So if race doesn't exist, but it exists, that's where the conversation gets really sticky for a lot of us. It doesn't exist because it's a made up thing. Race is mm-hmm. a made up thing, but it's been practiced for so long that it is a thing now that really affects real lives.
It's a social thing as opposed to necessarily a biological one, right?
Yeah. So it's a social construction.
Mm-hmm.
So getting our heads around what that means as a social construction that has become real.
And so lest people think that this is just, again, we're bringing up issues from the 60s and earlier, but this is still such a present reality that it even impacts news in 2013. You look back at the 50s and weren't there laws in the books that said marriage between different races was illegal, right? There was people who were punished and fined because if you had one drop of blood, I think that was the rule, one drop of mm-hmm. blood from a black family or something, then you could not marry a white person. And so whiteness was defined as this no drops of blood from other minorities. But in 2013, we're still defining whiteness and defining who
can
be white. It's
2015, yeah.
I know, but so in 2013, I don't know if you remember this, but on Fox News, Megyn Kelly came out defending the white Santa Claus. Do you guys remember that?
Yeah, no. I remember that.
Okay, so on this person who is speaking on national television comes out and says, they're trying to make Santa black. And she says, you know, this is ridiculous. Santa's white. And she goes on this rant. And then she says, just like Jesus, Jesus is white. And next thing you know, we're not going to have a white Jesus, which is a little bit unfortunate because obviously Jesus is not white. He's Middle Eastern, right? But it points to the fact that we get to define white however we would like. And it depends upon the person that we want to give them whiteness or not. And so race becomes this way of defining, like, if you're this way, we want you to be white. And if you're this way, we don't want you to be white. So it's definitely like a social construction, but it's still impacting us on a national level today, you know? And this is not a conversation that's old. This is one that we're still having because, like you said, those social constructions are still there.
And it is problematic to say, okay, us white people are going to solve racism now. We're swooping in to save the day because that's what we do best, you know? However, what is really rarely talked about, or I guess I'll back up and say this. Oftentimes when racial conversations come up, you want the token minority to come speak. And actually, I was guilty of this for this episode. I mean, I have this like, okay, I'll be totally honest. I have this panic, like, deep inside, I'm like, I don't want to cause any more harm with these conversations. I mean, not me personally. I'm sure I'm complicit in a lot of ways, you know, but I don't want to just make it worse. So I invited a notable professor that I know who's African-American and does amazing work in a lot of ways, but is particularly articulate about this particular issue, and asked them to come on the show and talk with us, wanted to work collaboratively and discuss these issues. And not only did they not get back to me, but I saw a rant posted on Facebook a couple of hours later after I sent this email saying, why are white people always asking me to come talk to them about racism? Why can't they just talk about it? Like, what's so hard? Just talk about it. I was like, ouch. So I guess you always have to start from personal experience, right? Mm-hmm. So if we're going to start from personal experience, we have to probably first define whiteness, because it's not, when we talk about racism, it's oftentimes like we think people with different colored skin. But what does different mean? It means not normal, different than me, different than the norm or who's in the center. So I think that leads us into talking about what whiteness is and white supremacy. Mm-hmm. Again, white supremacy, total trigger word. To think that I might be a white supremacist is really like, do you guys just cringe at that? Thinking about that?
Yeah, I don't think anyone can relate to those terms anymore. Like, I've sat down with friends and family to talk about racism, but nobody would ever say that they're a racist or that they're a white supremacist or anything like that. So I think to talk about this stuff, we really have to dig into its invisible attributes and really like name it where it's at, as opposed to just saying we're, you know, distance ourselves from those things.
Yeah,
yeah, that's really well said.
Yeah, and it's ironic is that a lot of the groups that would say that, well, racist is a harsh term, I'm not racist, da 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 da, are, especially within religious circles, are the same ones that use really weighted, heavy words to talk to them about themselves in light of who God is. You know, sinner, depraved, these really intense words, because it's important for them in that theological context to know how far off they are from the ideal so that they can strive harder for it. And it's amazing that they don't apply that same mentality when they're dealing with issues of race. Because even with the scriptural stuff, when I grew up, when they would talk about the Good Samaritan in the New Testament, it was never a race issue when they talked about it. It was always the Good Samaritan was the equivalent of a non-Christian, and you should have compassion for someone that doesn't believe. But the very definition of a Samaritan, it was all about race and how that racism within the Jewish community during that time, during Jesus's time, was so prevalent, and how Jesus was really addressing race and not what someone believed, and how that's been distorted, and how it pushes race as not even a topic to discuss about, even in Bible study when it's all over scripture.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing. I mean, I'm trying to think about like times in my life that I've really had to confront this. And that's the thing again, there's an amazing essay called, something like Privilege is a Backpack You Wear. I can't remember the name of it. I should have looked it up before the episode, but I will get you the link, Jeff. But it's about what privilege means. And the writer talks about how privilege is a backpack that you wear and you never take it off. It's just a backpack full of tools and privileges and like extra bonus perks that you have that other people don't have. And a lot of people are like, oh, I'm so sick of confronting my privilege. Or like, I've been in social circles or to parties or once. Or twice where it's actually I've heard people say to each other in complete earnestness, like, you just need to check your privilege right now, like in kind of a douchey way. I'm like, I don't want to be that person. However, it is important to talk about, and it's hard to talk about because by talking about it, you like almost strengthen its power, you know? So, but here's an example of what for me kind of hit home really recently. I was asked to participate in like a event for Black churches, like a gospel concert thing. And the woman who I met, just kind of like at the grocery store, but she asked me to be in this concert and, you know, I'm a musician, whatever. And she asked me for a headshot because she wanted to put it on the flyer. And she was really like, please send me your picture. And I was like, okay. And so she talked to me about it later. She's like, I really wanted to put your picture on the flyers so people would come to our neighborhood, people who look like you, because white people never come to where we are. And I was like, oh my God. Like, so I was the token minority in this particular case. And it was so strange to be in that role. I've never been one of the only white people in the room. And I thought, man, that's just so disheartening that in this year, 2015, like, we're still so segregated. Our neighborhoods are segregated. And a lot of times the neighborhoods of color just get crapped on. Like, that's where the cities decide to build freeways and dumps and processing plants. Like, those are the most devalued neighborhoods, and people don't cross mm-hmm. even physical location lines to really reach out and be neighborly. And so it's sad to me that the burden of addressing racism and talking across lines often falls to the people of color who are trying to do this work and make things more
so can
kindly.
I just say, I've heard from people that I respect and friends and family that just talk about whenever these issues come up on a national scale, like when Walter Scott was shot right in the back. He's running away from a police officer and he got shot. So there's this.
Oh, North Carolina.
And so there's this big national discussion about, you know, race and whether race played a role. And there are people that I know and love who have told me, like, well, honestly, the black community needs to start acting better so that they have a better presence in the world. And I think that, like, when we talk about race, you know how we're talking about it exists, but it doesn't exist. I think, like, talking to a people group like that, like, totally, it devalues the individual, in my opinion. Just talking like, you know, oh, this community needs to represent itself better, when race is this social construction that we have. That stuff still gets talked about by people in that way right now. Thinking about people as human beings, not saying that, you know, there is no differences between us and we just need to obliterate all that. There has to be some way of relating to each other that recognizes differences, but at the same time acknowledges that, like, people are humans. And we're not just going to group people together for these things. And we also have to be able to recognize that our society and our privilege are a part of our experience, too.
Yeah.
So holding all that stuff together is actually super difficult and tricky for anyone, regardless of whether you're someone who admits racism exists and you want to be sensitive. Like, this is such a difficult subject that, you're right, I think it's so much easier just not to talk about it and to let it remain invisible.
And I think it needs to happen on both sides of the political fence. Like, Alan, you mentioned this idea that says, well, the black community just needs to get everything together. And a lot of that rhetoric centered around, you know, black males need to step up and be there for their families. And if you change mm-hmm. their morality, everything's going to be fine. But even the other side of the fence on the left.
Which is actually a total myth, I have to say. It's actually been totally
a lot of these things are myth. Yeah, a lot of these things are mythical.
Yeah, and even on the side of the left, which the left side would be, well, our solution is, let's provide more government programs, which I'm not saying are not a good idea. I think that they are, but they're still in that. That's like a minor tweaking. That's like an oil change on a car that needs a whole new engine. Like, they're still not addressing on the left the severity and the bigness of the issue, and recognizing that maybe these extra social programs are a temporary fix, but they'll be there while we have real discussions about how to fix the system that caused it in the first place.
Yeah, absolutely. So we've talked about negative stereotypes, of course. Like, we're trying to always route those, you know, like, being politically correct is not a joke. It can make the difference between someone feeling safe in the room or not, right?
Absolutely.
And then we're talking about color, kind of, Alan, you touched on color blindness doesn't work. Like, you can't just say, well, I don't see race, you know, because basically you're trying to make everybody white. Like, that's how that mm-hmm. happens. Like, as soon as you try to erase difference or not acknowledge difference, it defaults to the norm, and that norm becomes even more powerful. And there's a third route for how people normally approach this thing, which becomes what is called in post-colonial studies, Orientalism. And those are some big words, but post-colonial comes out of, I'd love to do a whole episode on post-colonialism, but it comes out of how societies adapt to and respond to having been colonized. And colonialism can happen politically, economically, socially, culturally, whatever. Orientalism is a term coined by Edward Said in the 70s or 80s, I think the 80s. And he says, you know, just because you're treating people who are different than you as uber exotic and exciting, that mm-hmm. doesn't mean you're not racist either. That's the very simplified version of what he said. But here's an example of how this might work. If I go to another country and decide to plunder treasures that I find and then bring them back and exhibit them in my museum here because I know how to deal with precious antiques better than people whose country of origin that stuff comes from. I mean, there's so many examples of how this works. So I think it's really important not to orientalize or to treat people as exotic and like, oh, you're so special. Look how far away you've come from, or how beautiful and exotic you are. You know, that's all really problematic and still makes someone feel uncomfortable and unwelcome in a lot of ways.
Yeah. And so whether you're devaluing or fetishizing another, like a different person, it's still objectifying them instead of treating them as if they were another human being.
Yeah.
Like I had a friend who got her hair played with on the bus. Like some stranger started touching her hair and playing with it on the bus saying, oh my God, your hair is so beautiful. But like, I mean, almost petting her like a dog. Like, and this goes back to this idea that people of color really subconsciously, we have all been programmed to see people of color as less than human. And humanness is only reserved for people who have light colored skin. And that needs to just be put to rest forever. Yeah. Right?
Or even on the other end of that spectrum, like you two are saying, is that they're not less than, but just different.
Or more than. Yeah,
more than. So it's, and it, I think part of that is this denial that vocabulary matters. Well, that word or do this, but that doesn't make any sense. That's not even consistent with the overall arc of our culture. Like our culture, more than any other time in history, I would argue, language matters more because we're communicating in smaller bites. So the words that we use and the things that we communicate about certain issues become all the more important. And one of the catalysts for this conversation that we've had is a video, which we will post in the show notes, that Mona sent to us, talking about this idea of the marketing of racism and how the words and the way that we do things. And we live in a marketing culture, and it's that much more important that people of different colors are represented in, and I don't even want to use the word normal, but equal footing with every other race, because those images and those that vocabulary that we use does shape the way that we think about these things and adds to that subconscious racism that we all are victims of.
So one really pressing example of this, I know I keep bringing up anecdotes and someone could say, well, that's just, you know, one small example. This isn't in the video, but lest you think racism and the racist like system that we're born into doesn't even exist anymore. Just go to a makeup aisle in any store and go find a nude colored makeup, or try to look for nude colored shoes anywhere you want.
Flesh colored.
Yeah, like, yeah, so nude, right? Just flesh colored. And the question always is like, well, who's nude, right? It's always for white people, at least traditionally, and it still exists today. But like, even calling that nude, how is that nude color appropriate for nudeness in general? So those things happen on very small levels.
Yeah.
And, yeah, or like,
you mentioned that. Like, sorry, go ahead. No, go ahead.
No. Well, I was going to say, and along those lines, I think, and when some makeup company does for half a second, it's like, oh my God, look, we're celebrating all the colors of skin. And they'll do a big marketing campaign just to like make more money, you know? But that's what is referred to commonly as tokenism. Like, we're going to throw you guys a bone so you'll stop whining at us, but we're not really going to systematically solve the way we think about this philosophically for the long term, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that goes into like hiring people, like, we're going to hire someone of color so we look better, or so we like, so we can tell people we're not racist. Cause look, we have this token black person or Latina person in our office, you know, or I have a black friend, so I can't be racist. Yeah.
You know? And Ellen, you mentioned the idea of like all the anecdotal stuff you're putting up, but I think that's important. I think we dismiss it too often because it's not the anecdotal things, it's how we use it. And I think a lot of people, because they haven't experienced it firsthand, and then when they do, they take their experience and ram it into their current worldview instead of allowing their experience to expand their worldview. And I think that's the difference between when we have these anecdotal things, they should open up our minds and push us into new avenues of thought and really ideas. And I think that that's part of this, is that everyone has an anecdote about race, but what do we do with that anecdote? What do we do with that experience? And how do we allow that to shape our perspective and shape the way that we treat the people around us?
And we have to remember that our privilege as white people, which does exist, is a lot more invisible than the prejudices that other people face. When you're on one end, it's easier to say that it doesn't exist than on the other. And it's easier to look at it in a different way. Sorry, Mona.
There's some really interesting work coming out on the theological. I know we always try to kind of touch on the theology of this, but what do we do with this, especially religiously? Because I think it's one thing to just claim like Jesus is not for racism, you know? On the other hand, it's like, shouldn't it be our religious duty and our religious charge to address these systems that really ultimately hurt and maim and kill some people? You know, if this world is so unsafe for some because these systems and ideologies exist, I really do think it should be a theological and religious and faith-filled task to address these things and try to unpack them. And I'm thinking of a really important book that came out in the theological world called The Cross and the Lynching Tree by an amazing academic named James H. Cone, C-O-N-E. And he talks about the symbols of the cross and the lynching tree as being really close together in African-American communities, and talking about how basically, I mean, there's a lot to this book, but I really recommend it. It's really amazing. And another one I recommend is called Jesus and the Disinherited by Howard Thurman. And both of these works talk about, I'll use the terms of Thurman, who is a civil rights era theologian, how Jesus was almost can be considered like a black person of his society, because he was amongst the lowest classes in a colonized society. And so Jesus is the savior of those who, and what the words Thurman used were, those whose backs are against the wall, those who are afraid for their lives, often who are trying to survive. And this image of like the cross is in the lynching tree, like Jesus being lynched, and Jesus and African-American communities in particular, and people of color in general, being lynched and crucified on a regular basis in our society. Like, that's a really emotive, powerful thing to think about. But if you really let that sink in for a little bit, seeing Jesus as someone in solidarity with people who experience race-based violence is like, that has been really, really life-changing for me to start thinking differently about those things.
Well, even the birth of the church, it was a struggle on how do we incorporate another race into what we do? Like the whole Gentile Jewish thing, the whole basis of how the church even progressed from the point that it did was this difficult ongoing discussion is how do we incorporate our race with the race of these other people, and how do we make a larger community?
Yeah.
So we fixed everything?
We did.
I see that this topic is, it touches on so many conversations I've had with people, and it's hard to even know where I'm at in all of this. And for a lot of my friends who experience this stuff on a daily basis, because they're on the receiving end of some of the crap that I hear, it's even hard to talk about because I know it's painful for so many people. So,
yeah. So, and we can't speak for people because we don't know, like our skin makes us privileged, you know, but what we can talk about is dismantling white supremacy.
Yeah.
Right. Both in ourselves and around us.
Naming it and claiming it is the first step to overcoming it. Like seeing where it is and admitting that we benefit, like, is an important first step, I think.
Yeah.
Mm. Yeah.
So what are like some practical ways we can do this to challenge white supremacy in like our day-to-day worlds?
I think starting by just acknowledging that it exists and and choosing the way that we approach it and being able to recognize immediately, not even necessarily immediately, but even in reflection, like, oh, wow, this is something about me that I didn't realize was there. Or even putting ourselves in a situation where we're confronted with that so that it becomes more of a reality that gives us an even more desire to want to change that or move forward.
I think for me, I've had these conversations with some people. A lot of times it's a white person who is having a conversation with someone else who is not white, and the issue of race comes up, and the white person gets very defensive and is saying, I'm not a racist, I didn't mean that racially, and this person is taking it racially. I think for us, a first step would be to, at the very least, and this may seem patronizing and I don't want it to be, at the very least, to understand why people are primed in our society to see racism because they faced it so often. So just because you didn't mean that term in a racist way, or just because you didn't have racism on your mind, when someone responds sensitively to that subject and to something you've done, even if you didn't intend to be racist, to at least stop for a second and realize that you live in a world where that stuff exists.
Yeah.
And so it's okay when someone responds that way to not right away turn defensive and to actually think through, and then even to entertain the notion that it's possible that you just participated in connection with something that's bigger than yourself, that is a racist part of society, whether it's language or actions or whatever. So at first, not being defensive, that's the very first step. And then secondly, like really analyzing where your heart's at and what the situation is to see if there is some sort of invisible thing going on.
And recognize that you've tapped into a part of that person's story that touched a nerve, and take the time to figure out where that's coming from to gain more understanding in that situation.
Those are great. Those are great ideas. And I think for me, part of this has been just being friends with people of color and stop being afraid. I know that sounds really silly, but so I grew up in California, you know, and my high school was pretty segregated as far as the kids go. It was like 70% Hispanic community. And I realized that, like, even through college and after college, I really didn't hang out with people who weren't white, you know? And so seeing that in myself, that like, why am I drawn to this people that I'm drawn to? Is it because I'm I just have more in common with them, or because I'm really am like a little bit reluctant to like talk to people who are look different than me or who are different than me and be their friend. And then on the other hand, I had a roommate from Nigeria who so technically didn't consider herself African-American so much, like didn't have the history of her family's lineage through the American slave trade, like migrated from Africa in recent years. So those are two distinct groups in some ways. But anyway, she's the one who recommended Black Like Me to me, which is why I read it. But one day I sat down and I was just asking her questions about racism, because I was just like, I had no clue about any of this, you know, none of it. And she said, she kind of took pause. She was like, normally I wouldn't take the time to explain this to people. Like, but because you're so earnest and you want to know, like, I will explain this to you, but just so you know, like, I walk around my whole life with people constantly asking me to explain things to them. Like, I have to educate everyone around me mm-hmm. all the time, and it's really exhausting. So mm-hmm. she's like, I'll tell you some things, but I really want you to go read this book and then we'll talk more about it. You know, she was really guiding me through a process. But all that to say, yes, it's great to listen to people. It is absolutely vital to listen deeply and to care and to check yourself and say, well, maybe I did cause offense here. But on the other side, don't ask people to constantly educate you. You have the internet. You have the internet. You can go read about this stuff. I mean, it's all over the place if you just take the time to educate yourself. Yeah. And I've had to do that. I think we covered all of it. Did we cover all of it?
We did. We solved the world's racist problem.
We solved it. Here we come.
So and for anyone listening, we'd love to hear your perspectives, your stories, things that you can educate us. Just like she said, we're going to force you to educate us about your experiences of the world. But seriously, if you disagree that race exists, racism doesn't exist anymore or whatever, we'd still love to hear what your own stories are about this subject. So feel free to email us.
And reconciliation is so important. I mean, we all do want to get to the point where racism isn't an issue anymore, right? That's the goal, mm-hmm. I think. But I think, yes, no, yes.
Yes, emphatically, yes.
Emphatically. One thing, without erasing difference, without erasing
yeah. difference. I was going to say, if we can ever get there, yeah.
Yeah, but diversity is beautiful, you know, and so cultivating an aesthetic that allows for and embraces diversity without trying to conform everyone into the same stupid little box, that's good, you know. Humanity is supposed to be varied, you know. One thing that I really like, and again, this is a big word, but don't focus so much on the word. It comes out of philosophy. It's called cosmopolitanism. The idea that we are all citizens of the great cosmos. Like, we are all globally united and interconnected. And so really listening to someone and getting to know them and treating them like the dignified human being that they are, treating them not only with respect but with kindness, means encountering their face. And this comes out of a theologian I really like, who works out of Bright Divinity in Texas, named Nansum Kong. And she talks about encountering the face of another person. Everybody's face is particular. It's unique to them. There's nobody who has your exact face, unless you're twins, Jeff.
Well, even then, I'll tell you from firsthand that they're very, very different.
Very different.
Very different.
Jeff has twin baby girls. Yeah. But, you know, all that to say is if we really take someone seriously as being particular, is that everyone has a unique and wonderful story, every single person out there. And we're all citizens of the globe. So getting past all these national identity politics and all of the legal debates around citizenship were really problematic, and all the socioeconomic differences and local divides. I mean, there's so many things that divide us now, but really thinking about how we are all, it sounds incredibly simple, but it's actually really profound. We are all citizens of the globe. All of us, we all have equal share in the globe. And what might that look like to really live that out?
And every single one is different. I think that's a really good point that mm-hmm. needs to be.
It sounds like owned. A Sesame Street episode.
It does.
We're all different. Oh,
yeah. Well, I think that's a good place to kind of a good mark to end this conversation. Well, hopefully begin new conversations for those of you that are listening. And again, like Alan said, if you have anything you'd like to add to the conversation, we will have a question for you on our Facebook page at facebook.com/Irenicast that you can respond to so that we can continue this conversation there in a respectful and loving manner that acknowledges that diversity and that beauty in every single person. So with that being said, on the other side of the music, we are going to share with you some insight on some of our favorite life hacks, and we are going to call it Irenahacks. Stay tuned. Well, this week we are going to, it's not really playing a game, but we're going to have a segment where we're going to talk about our favorite life hacks, and we're going to call this Irena Hacks, which I'm super proud of coming up with that name, by the way.
You're so proud of it.
I really am. It's I just like playing off the word Irenicon, apparently.
That's right. That's right.
We just like puns. We're punny folks. I'm bad at the puns, but I appreciate it.
The word Irenic means peace. So if these are hacks that bring more peace into your life and make things easier, maybe it fits. Or,
it does.
Or are they ways to get around peace?
Well, they provide us peace of mind so that we have an easier life, because that's what we're all striving for, is to live a life like in Wall-E, right? Where we can eventually just sit down and eat all the time.
Wall-E.
Want to be Wall-E.
Or anyway, peace hacks. Okay.
So anyway. these hacks are ones that we actually use. These are ones that we're not just hear about and think they're interesting. These are ones that we actually use on a fairly regular basis within our lives. So this is, again, another insight into who is Jamonin. So this is the crux of that. So who wants to start? Who wants to share their favorite life hack?
I'll start.
Okay.
Okay. So I kind of have a theory that lazy people will inherit the earth, meaning that if you are lazy and annoyed enough at your surroundings, that sometimes you'll just do something. You'll take the time to do something to try to find a hack about it, right? Which is why the beauty of life hacks. Anyway, I hate messy computer cables. I don't know if it's because the way I grew up, whatever, but just having cords and cables all over the place, just crazy. Or like, you know, when you have a computer cord and you're trying to plug everything in and the thing drops behind the desk and the desk weighs 50 pounds and you have to move everything. I just, all of that just is my nightmare. So I love this hack and I use it at home. You get those little binder clips and you stick your cords in the binder clips and then binder clip the cord to the desk. So the cord can never, ever fall in the crack. It's so beautiful.
That's actually a really good idea. I don't think I've ever seen that. Did you come up with that?
No, I saw it online, but I've used it and it's awesome. So I recommend. That's
pretty brilliant. I'm writing that down.
Isn't that a good one?
That is a good one. I hate cords too, so that's great. I'm a fan.
Ellen. So my hack is an Irena hack in the sense that it makes you a more empathetic person, in my opinion. And it's something that I've been doing probably for like 3 or 4 years now. I have a lot of Facebook friends, and if you're like me, you don't keep up on all of them. And it's hard sometimes to even interact with all of my Facebook friends. So every single day, I check my Facebook every day because that's me. And I always go to the Facebook walls of whoever's birthday it is. It's just this weird little habit I have. And I'll click on the actual names that show up, go to their page, just look at what they're doing, like how they are. And it's usually only a few people at a time, so it doesn't take very long. And that way, every single year, it means I've visited the Facebook page of my friends and family at least once. And so it gives me,
remarkably sweet.
It keeps me fresh on like what they're up to and helps build my empathy. Funny thing, years after I was doing that, Vicky and I were reading something on BuzzFeed. It was this article put out there that talked about, and maybe this is your life hack. Maybe you can tweak it to fit your reality. But BuzzFeed put out an article that was very close to what I was doing for a long time. And their suggestion was to clean up your Facebook friends. Just look at the birthdays every day. And if it's someone you don't want to be a friend with, defriend them. So that way you can clean up your friends list, which is like
your evil twin version of what that means.
Yeah. But hey, they're at least customizing their Facebook experience the way they want to have it. So if you want to be a more empathetic person, click on those profiles and just look at them.
Ellen, I would be terrified to meet your evil twin because you're so kind that your evil twin would be just an evil genius.
Evil genius.
That could be dangerous for someone that's super codependent, though. And that's just true. Encourage so that part of them.
That's actually the darker side of my
where they feel they have to do that because they don't want to upset anyone on their Facebook feed. And then they put this big stress on them to make sure that they connect with everyone all the time.
That should never be a stress. It's just something. And if you skip days or whatever, it's just a way to stay connected with people. You shouldn't just tapping into something. I used to struggle very much with codependency, especially when I was younger. And that's something that I've had to come over. So that's the darker side of, you know, being a
little person. Oh, dude, darker. Check your privilege, man. I just
excuse me.
That is
the more unfortunate.
I do it all the time, but we have to stop doing it.
No, it's true.
It's so hard to stop. Dark means evil. Oh, we got to stop doing
it. Vocabulary is absolutely important. It is.
Yeah.
Yes.
If not, Kay, thanks, bye. I'll see you later.
Kay, thanks, bye. All right, Jeff, your turn.
All right, my favorite life hack of all time is, this is kind of becoming a theme for me in the last few episodes, but it comes from Alton Brown. And it is, last few years, I've been trying to do more cooking and stuff like that. And he invented this thing on one of his shows called the Blowhard 2000.
do you want to know what this is?
You absolutely want to know what it is because it's amazing and everyone should do this. So you get a regular square fan, you know, the ones you plug in, they're like, what, 10 bucks at like Rite Aid or something like that.
A box fan?
A box fan. There you go. Yep. And you get a couple of those vent filters that you put in for your air conditioning and some bungee cords. And then between those, you can get the dehydrator sheets and you put like, you can do beef jerky, you can dry fruit, you can dry your herbs. And then you put them in between the layers of the vents and then you wrap bungee cords around the fan. You turn the fan on and then you put it in your bathroom or whatever for a cool, dark place for a couple days while it dries. So it's like a dehydrator. It's like a makeshift dehydrator.
Because does it make your bathroom smell like beef jerky?
Yes, it does, which is not a bad thing. I dried strawberries in it, and it tasted like strawberries throughout the whole house for days. It was amazing. And not only that, but like, because most dehydrators actually cook your food, and you don't want to cook it. You want to just take the moisture out. So this works out even better than you could buy for like a $100 dehydrator. And it's like, it costs like 15 bucks to make. And I've done it so many times, awesome. And it's my favorite thing in the world.
What's your favorite thing to dry in it?
It's strawberries, the fruit. Because then you make your own trail mix. It's amazing.
That's awesome.
So I'm going to put a link to the show notes to that clip from the show because he used it several times throughout the course of Good Eats. And it is a great invention. So thank you, Alton Brown, because I know you're listening. I hope you're listening. I wish you're listening. If you are listening, mention us on your Twitter feed because, you know. Anyway.
Hey, Jeff, you should write him a letter and I'll take it to him,
all
right?
I've already written several letters all the time. No, I'm just joking.
I would freak out if he joined the fan. Alton Brown, if you're listening, we trust you are listening. You hear everything, I think. He's like the Chuck Norris of food. That's what I think.
That is a good way to describe him.
If this gets back to you, Alton Brown, I would like credit for that quote. And come over and let's all make dinner.
Let's. That'd be the best show ever. We could just record it and it would be a podcast and everyone in the world would listen to it. Anyway, I'm sorry. My fandom is going out of control here. Go ahead. Who's next?
I'm getting because it's a fan.
Oh, wow.
Funny.
Okay, my turn. See, okay, this is the thing. I have two, but one of them is completely stupid and the other one's only slightly stupid. So which one do you want to hear?
The completely stupid
one. Yeah, completely stupid.
Okay. One time I went to a bonfire and you know how the fire makes your hair smell real gross?
Oh, I hate that.
I love that smell. But yeah.
Okay, but the next morning, like you wake up and you're like, ugh. And if you don't have time to shower, so if this particular thing happens in this sequence, you go to a bonfire and you don't have time to shower and it's the next day. You know what takes the campfire out of your hair, which I learned. I made this up, I think. I had not heard it anywhere. If you rub your hair with dryer sheets, totally takes the smell out.
Interesting.
It's completely stupid, isn't it? I was really proud of myself.
How many bonfires did you have to come up to the point where you had to come up with a life hack?
We were youth pastors. Isn't bonfires like part of what you do every summer a million times? I hate that smell too. That's actually not a bad idea, but I hate the smell of dryer sheets.
I don't like hygiene in general, so I avoid hygiene. So I hate hygiene more than I hate smelling like
I'm campfire. So glad then we're doing this over Skype.
Yeah. Well, you probably smell like strawberries all the time, so whatever.
Well, you know. That's what I do. That's good though. That's good. That's a good problem to solve.
So I gave one life hack about building up your empathy. And then the second one is about indulging your nostalgia. I'm a very nostalgic person. I like to think about the past. It's not because the present's really bad or anything, okay? It's just because I like thinking about the past. And I use Pandora to listen to music. That's a free radio on the internet where you can put up a song. Or
I think it's safe to assume if someone found a podcast, they know what Pandora is.
Sure.
Just crawled out of a cave somewhere.
It's like Spotify.
Or Pandora.
Yeah. So basically you enter in an album or a song or a singer, and then it will create a playlist of songs based off of that album or singer. And then you can like and dislike songs so that it creates a more and more appropriate playlist, and you name it whatever you want. So I recommend as a life hack to make your nostalgic sessions, if you have them like me, more productive, get on Pandora, create a playlist and call it Adolescence, and then pretend as if you were your adolescent self and like songs that you would have liked and dislike songs that you didn't like, even though now you have different tastes. And so like I've done that for the past year, I've been doing that on my adolescent station. So there's all these like rock band, like rock. I used to listen to a lot of rock, like Puddle of Mud and Stained and all these other people. And then there's some really cheesy stuff that I probably wouldn't listen to anymore. But when I get in that mood, I turn it on and it takes me right back there. And I'm in high school again.
Your life hacks are so existential.
My whole life is existential, okay? And it's exhausting. It's exhausting.
Jeff, yours are productive, I guess. I don't know. We'll hear
that's
from
true.
The last one, I guess. But
wow. Yeah, it's interesting what we all view as a life hack. Like,
okay, I thought
this was an agreed upon term.
I thought so too.
I think what we're coming down to is Alan's not a very handy person, and he doesn't, you know, have any way to make your life better by doing something more clever.
I didn't say
this
that.
Is what I have to offer.
No, right? I think what we're doing here on this podcast is we are creating levels of life hacks. So you have practical ones that make your life easy, and then you have these ones that make your state of mind easy and create experiences when you're just in your home. So we are taking this to a next level. That's why we're calling it I Rent a Hacks, because that
extreme
exactly
a study just came out that said it's actually experiences that make you happier than physical things. So my life hacks are the best kind of life hacks, because I'm giving you an experience that will make your life better and more happy.
But then practical life hacks are creating you time to have those experiences.
There you go.
Oh, boom. Everybody wins.
I think so. I really think we're onto something here. We could do a whole separate podcast about these issues and how we are solving the world's problem one playlist at a time. Okay.
Okay, Jeff.
My life hack, very practical. It was one I saw online with one of those things. You know the little, when you open a soda can, the little top thing that always falls off that you play with if you're fidgety?
The tab. Mm-hmm.
The tab, yeah. I use those because one of my big problems is closet space. You know, I'm super manly. So
everyone's problem.
Exactly. So a lot of them are t-shirts. I don't like to fold my t-shirts in my dresser drawer because then they come out wrinkled. So I like to hang them. But I have a lot of t-shirts. So I use those little tabs to put two hangers on each other. So you use one little tab to put there and then a hanger on the other end of that tab so that they're both together, and it doubles my closet space. And I have a whole little baggie of those tabs in my kitchen for that very purpose.
You know, it also works with hangers, because I always have clothes slip off the hanger. Maybe that's not such a problem for dudes, but for my clothes, like if you just put rubber bands on the hanger, then it holds your clothes on better.
Oh, really?
There's so many hanger things that you could do. Yeah.
I don't think I have that issue of things slipping off, but Kat does, because her clothes are, you know, I don't wear deep V-necks or anything like that.
You don't?
I don't have the physique for it. Or, you know.
I'm picturing this and it's so funny.
No one wants a hairy cleavage special.
Okay. Hey, to be upfront, we have not released our episode on gender, but it's coming up. So if you're offended by what Jeff's saying, just give it a few episodes.
Yeah, it's all
time. Everything will be fine. I promise.
I'm so excited about that series that we're going to do.
Yeah, me too.
Yes, and stay tuned for that, because on our 10th episode, we'll be talking about a series of podcasts we'll be doing from episode 11 on that we're very excited about and that we're working on right now. So that's a little teaser for everyone listening. All right, does anyone have any other
just
life
a little
hacks?
Tease?
I just have to say one more life hack, guys, because I did research and I found way too many ideas. But this one I thought was so cool. You cut the lid off.
So just to be clear, this is one that you think is cool, but you do not utilize on a regular basis.
I don't use it. Okay. I mean, can I still talk about it?
You can.
You're changing the game, but that's fine. Go for it.
This is beyond the game. This is just trying to make your... I'm doing you a favor.
Well, this whole segment is changing the game. So
it is.
Let's continue on.
Okay. Just let me get a hand raise. Does anyone listening right now find that opening cereal boxes is just a pain? The cereal always goes stale. You can never get it folded properly in the box. And then the boxes take up way too much space. Yes, this is a universal problem with cereal.
Any life hack concerning cereal is worth listening to. So continue.
See, thank you. I appreciate that. So what you do is you cut the top of a bottle off, like a flip top, like a juice bottle or something. You know how like they have the little flip tops things to screw on and flip. So you cut just the top of that on and then you put the bag in it so that this is actually quite hard to describe. So that you get a little pouch and then you get the screw on top and then you can just flip the lid up and pour the cereal out. I'll send you a picture.
Send us a picture. Everyone look right now at the picture.
There should be cereal boxes should come with that already on them.
My child,
like flip tops.
My childhood life hack for cereal was to open the box upside down so I get to the toy faster.
Oh yeah.
That's serious business when you're a kid.
Yeah, seriously. I was noticing on like I was at the cereal section the other day, and for kids' cereal now it's all like, hey, log on here and download this app and
yeah.
Dude, we like took scissors and like cut shapes out. Like we, you know, kids have come a long way in the last few years. Okay, it's sending you guys this picture.
Okay, great. we'll try to put this picture somehow on the show notes, or if you go to the blogcast on the or the blogcast, if you go to the blog iranicast.com, you'll be able to see the picture. We'll put it in the post itself. So check that out. So I think that'll do it for this week. So thank you so much for joining us. Don't forget to email us or check us out on Facebook and let us know which segment and which conversation you'd like to hear for our 10th episode. And if you haven't yet, rate, review, and subscribe to us on iTunes. That really helps the visibility of our show. And if you're an Android listener, you can check us out on Stitcher as well. Follow us on Twitter at Irenicast. And again, check out our blog at irenicast.com. So for this week, I'm Jeff.
I'm Mona.
And I'm Alan.
Thanks for joining the conversation. Thank you.